Hello, and welcome to part 7 of my podcast, All About Antarctica. I'm Dr. Steve Emsley, and I'm a professor in the Department of Biology and Marine Biology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, where I've been teaching an undergraduate class titled Antarctic Ecology, Geology, History, and Policy. In this podcast, I have distilled this class down into numerous parts that cover all these topics about Antarctica. Part 7 today will be on terrestrial ecology. In previous podcasts, we've already gone over why Antarctica is the coldest, windiest, and most remote place on Earth, and why it's so much colder than the Arctic, even though both polar regions receive about the same amount of solar radiation per year. The cold, harsh conditions in Antarctica severely limit terrestrial life, and there are no vertebrates that inhabit this region. Remember, no polar bears. Though there are millions of penguins and seals that come ashore in Antarctica, they are marine species and spend most of their lives at sea or on the pack ice. Species that are fully terrestrial are very restricted here and are limited to lichens, mosses, two flowering plants, plus one insect, and some tiny invertebrates and bacteria that live in the soil. Some algae actually grows on snow, while some ultra-cold bacteria live and function in the ice in temperatures down to minus 20 degrees Celsius. Bacteria has even been found in the ice at the South Pole and probably got there by atmospheric transport sometime in the past. Let's first look at plant life, as it's the most visible of terrestrial life in Antarctica. There is a surprising diversity of species of lichens and mosses, mainly in coastal areas. Lichens are comprised of a mutualistic relationship between algae and fungi. The algae provides photosynthetic products, while the fungi absorbs water and provides protection from ultraviolet or UV radiation. It is a very successful relationship, as the fossil record, while scant for this group, indicates lichens have been around for at least 400 million years. There are three types of lichens that you may already be familiar with. The crustose lichens are small and scale-like, that you see tightly attached to the surface of rocks and other substrates, while fructicose lichens are shrubby in appearance, like tiny trees, and folios lichens are leaf-like and, unlike crustose lichens, they are attached to substrates from their bottom center, with the edges curled outwards like a dry leaf, and can be quite large. I have seen all three types in Antarctica, and they grow well where there is some moisture and lots of nutrients, such as at old abandoned penguin colonies, where the nutrients from guano enriches the soil. They also are quite colorful, with varying shades of yellow, orange, red, and green, intermixed on boulders and rocks or across the landscape. These pigments, along with lichen acids, prevent them from freezing down to about minus 10 degrees Celsius. I have seen entire terraces covered with fructicose lichens, looking like a colorful lawn. If you get down on your stomach and look at them at eye level, it becomes a forest, the only forest you'll see in Antarctica today. Lichen diversity is greatest in the Antarctic Peninsula, where there are about 150 species. The continent in general has about 120 species, including the most southerly lichen in the world at 87 degrees south latitude, or within about 400 kilometers of the South Pole. Otherwise, there can be localized hotspots of lichen diversity, such as, again, around penguin colonies, where there are more nutrients available. There is one other type of lichen that is quite unusual. It grows inside of rocks. It's called endolithic lichen, for inside rock, and escapes cold, harsh conditions on sandstone cliffs and exposures by growing a few millimeters below the outer surface of the rock. They are quite common in the dry valleys where strong winds scour the rock with blowing sand and ice crystals, and extreme cold temperatures prevail. Here, just about any rock surface is off-limits to normal lichen growth. The sandstone is coarse enough, though, for light and water to penetrate to where lichens can live, and now the algae and fungi in the lichen are no longer intermixed. Instead, the fungi have separated into a thin layer, a dark layer, just below the outer surface of the rock, with a green layer of algae below that. There are also reddish layers on the outside surface of the rock, and inside below the line of algae, that are iron precipitates caused by a chemical reaction with the lichen acids. Little is known about these lichens, but it appears that there is a thriving mini-ecosystem inside these rocks. Mosses also are abundant in Antarctica, where there is enough moisture for them to thrive as they require wet and moist soils to grow. Mosses are sometimes confused with lichens, but they are non-vascular, non-flowering bryophytes that consist of densely packed stems without roots. These stems are especially dense in Antarctic moss to minimize water loss in the cold, dry environment. Mosses lack the diversity of colors that lichens have, but they do have a considerable range in shades of green to yellowish green, and together with lichens provide a rich array of colors to the rocks and soils where they grow. Antarctica is not as black as white as you might think. Even the surface of snow can be colorful, as red and green algae can live and grow on snow. There are only two flowering plants in Antarctica, a grass, Deschampsia antarctica, with deep roots to hold it in place from the winds, and a pearlwort, Colobanthus quitensis, often found in association with the grass. These are the most southerly flowering plants in the world. Both these plants are wind-pollinated, as there are no insects in Antarctica to pollinate them. They can be locally abundant where more nutrients and soils are available, especially again at old abandoned penguin colonies. I have found some of these abandoned colonies just by looking for a thick covering of grass in localized areas on tops of hills and ridges. Probing underneath the grass, I find pebbles, eggshell, and bones of penguin chicks, all evidence that a colony that once existed there. Although these two flowering plants are mainly restricted to the northern and western Antarctic Peninsula and maritime islands, where there is more moisture and milder temperatures, the recent warming trends in this region have allowed them to expand farther to the south along the west side of the peninsula. What about invertebrates in the terrestrial environments of Antarctica? I mentioned already that there is only one native insect, again found only in the northern peninsula. This insect is a tiny flightless midge, Belgica antarctica, and can survive year-round, enduring the Antarctic winter in a frozen, resting stage. Believe it or not, it is also the largest terrestrial animal in Antarctica. I've seen larvae of this species in tiny pockets of water on boulders just barely visible to the naked eye. They also live and feed in mosses and algae. In recent decades, at least two other non-native insects have appeared in the northern Antarctic Peninsula, another midge, but one that can fly, and a small dipteran fly that's been found at research stations on King George Island. Both possibly arrived on food shipments to the research stations, though with the warming trend, a natural dispersal from Patagonia cannot be ruled out. There are other invertebrates in Antarctic soils and vegetation, including nematodes, springtails, mites, and tardigrades. If you're a gardener, you are probably already familiar with these creatures. Nematodes are small roundworms and feed on bacteria and protozoa in the soil. They are quite abundant worldwide, in fact, one of the most numerous species on Earth that you don't see. The springtails prefer moist soils and are important in breaking down organic debris, along with mites. Mites are the largest terrestrial predators in Antarctica, preying on springtails and even each other. There are brown and red forms, and I have seen them in large concentrations under rocks at penguin colonies, giving the rock a red color that at first looks like lichen. All these species are important in nutrient cycling in the soil, and with the bacteria, fungi, and protozoa, are part of a thriving micro-community in Antarctica that comprise a majority of terrestrial species found there. These species also are found in soils worldwide, but in Antarctica, as with the midge, their numbers are more limited, but they are adapted to survive the long winter in a frozen or desiccated state. Tardigrades, also known as water bears, are particularly impressive. They feed on lichens and mosses, can withstand temperatures down to minus 200 degrees Celsius, or as high as 100 degrees Celsius, the boiling point of water. They can dry up and survive in a state of desiccation for 10 years and then revive with moisture. This seems like a species that could have reached Earth on asteroids from space. I mentioned soils, so one last thing I want to say about terrestrial environments in Antarctica is that there are also a diversity of soil types, a substrate that is important habitat for the plants and animals discussed here. A true soil takes centuries to develop layers or horizons that soil scientists use to classify different soil types. These horizons develop from vegetative decay at the surface, followed by nutrient transport via water percolation into the ground. There are many types of soils depending on the amount of vegetation, the local climate, and the grain sizes of the soil that determine how deep and how fast water can percolate, and at what depth and thickness the horizons appear. Next time you see an open pit or trench excavated in a natural setting, look at the profile and see if you can make out dark and light-colored horizons that develop there based on the local climate and vegetation. As you can imagine, with the sparsity of vegetation and the cold, dry climate, soils in Antarctica would take much longer to form horizons than in other regions of the world. One soil type in particular is unique to Antarctica, the gelisols. These soils are typified by being below freezing in temperature, but not frozen like permafrost. Instead, the dry, cold conditions keep them unfrozen, despite the cold temperatures, since there is little to no moisture in them. Another soil type that is also found in other parts of the world is ornithogenic, or bird-formed soil. These are soils formed at seabird breeding colonies, and penguins in Antarctica provide the best source for them there. The smaller penguins, the Adelie, Chinstrap, and Gentoo, collect pebbles to build their nests. They return to the same nest site each year and rebuild the nest so that over time, the pebbles along with the guano, bones, and other organic remains accumulate and form these soils. It may take hundreds of years for them to form, and when the colony is abandoned, the soil will eventually dry out and take on a reddish hue from the pigments in krill and the guano. Although you would think these nutrient-rich soils would be full of invertebrates, the microenvironment is too extreme for most, with its high levels of nitrogen and acids. Even tardigrades are absent. There are one or two species of nematodes adapted to these soils, but otherwise only bacteria really dominate in them. I'll come back to these soils in a later podcast. The last soil type I want to mention here also is found in other parts of the world, cryptogamic soil. Cryptogamic means hidden reproduction, and these soils are characterized by a surface crust dominated by non-flowering plants such as lichens and mosses. These are spore-producing plants, so do not have seeds, hence the name cryptogamic. These soils, then, are quite common in Antarctica, but I have seen cryptogamic soils in the southwestern United States, where you can find small to large areas where the soil has a thin crust composed of lichens, fungi, and bacteria with high UV tolerance. The crust they form stabilizes the soil, while gas exchange of nitrogen and carbon into the soil is still possible. You might look for these next time you are in an arid region in the West, but avoid walking on them as the crust breaks through and takes a long time to restabilize. Thank you for listening to my podcast, All About Antarctica. I'm Dr. Steve Emsley of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and I hope you tune in to Part 8 on Antarctic Lakes.